I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. This time last year, I sat down with today's guest to talk about where the country was headed, politically, culturally, and historically. A lot has changed since then, and some things feel eerily familiar. Joining me today is John Hood, a historian, author, conservative thinker, and one of North Carolina's most consistent voices on public policy, governance, and political history. We're going to start with Washington, how the current administration is governing, how power is being exercised, and how the tone of national leadership has shifted over the past year. Then we'll turn to Venezuela, an aggressive foreign policy move that's raised serious questions about U.S. power, global stability, and unintended consequences. We'll also look ahead to the 2026 midterm elections, what history tells us, what may be different this time, and what voters are really responding to beneath the noise. And before we close, we'll pause to remember the life and legacy of Governor Jim Hunt, a leader who shaped North Carolina for decades and whose passing at the end of 2025 marks the end of an era. John, thank you for locking in with me. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, Algernon. How are you?
Man, I'm doing well. I think you kicked off the year for us last year in 2025. And you're kicking off the year again this year. So I think we'll just start with the most obvious question. What are your thoughts about the last year or so?
Well, I hope you're not holding me responsible for what happened in 2025, just because I, quote, kicked it off. But it was what I more or less expected, a combination of things. The punditry about Donald Trump and the Trump administration, which I participated in ever since he came down the golden escalator, tends to go in extremes. He's the second coming of something, or he is a would-be fascist dictator, or he is the most crooked president ever, or he is the most honest president that tells it the way it is. I mean, there's these kind of wild, extreme views on Trump. I'm not a big fan, as is evident from what I've been saying and writing for a dozen years. But I also think it is important to judge public officials according to what they do on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. In other words, I can have profound disagreements with President Trump, as I do, on a variety of matters like economic policy, tariffs, the role that government should play and can play in economic development, conduct of his office, the way he uses his pardon powers. I have a lot of criticisms. That doesn't mean I can't say that I don't like his deregulation efforts in the energy markets, which I'm in favor of, or that I didn't like aspects of the reconciliation bill that passed last summer, because I did. I liked some of the health care provisions. I liked the welfare reforms. I liked some of the rate reductions in the tax code. I disliked other parts of the bill. I disliked the break on tips and other kinds of special gifts in the tax code that the president and Congress put in that bill. I didn't like the fact that it expanded the deficits. So the way I think about this is I can judge people in politics, local, state, federal, and I do, and write about that and say that. And I have said many things about Trump's character that are not exactly laudatory. And I can evaluate each individual act on its own terms. So, for example, I disagree quite a bit with how the president has so far, at least, conducted America's relationship with Russia and Ukraine. On the other hand, I more or less agree with what the Trump administration has done in the Middle East. And when it comes to Venezuela, I have thoughts, but I also think that there are unanswered questions that make it difficult for me to judge right now what I think is going to happen in the long run. So that's the way I'm just setting the table for you, Algernon. I'm not going to come on here and say what a wonderful year or what a ceaselessly terrible year, because I don't think either is accurate. It was a mixed bag. And that's true whether you just are a person experiencing the news and the events, and the actions of government, or if you follow politics closely and you have strong rooting interests, the Democrats, the Republicans, or the left, or the right. I think you can find moments in 2025 that make you smile and moments in 2025 that make you grimace.
Well, I know last year when we kicked the year off, I think we started out with the word uncertainty. And I think that was the word of the year for last year, just a tremendous amount of uncertainty. And I, you know, as I listened to you talk through some of Trump's policies, I think the challenge for people, including myself, who I would also consider myself a pundit, and I've written about the president and his policies, and I think my audience knows where I stand on a lot of these things. But I think it's been difficult for people to try to separate his personality from the policies. And you're right, a lot of the policies are effective and they do make sense, but it's like his personality just comes in and sort of ruins it for everyone. And,
well,
you know,
and I can't disagree, Algernon, but in part because there is this thesis that I've seen many advance, including longtime friends of mine, that say, well, don't care about his personality. Ignore his mean tweets. Just focus on the policies. Well, that is not an accurate depiction of how politics really works.
That's right.
How leadership really works. That's just not, you can't do that. And it doesn't mean you can't disagree with particular policies and yet like the person. And it can't mean you can dislike the person and yet agree with some of his policies. But they are separate things. But the role that a president plays for the nation, and honestly, the American president plays for the world.
Right.
And for example, to bring it closer, the role a governor plays in a state level political conversation, maybe even the role a mayor or a local official plays at a local level, it goes beyond their votes. It goes beyond their policies. It has to do with how they conduct themselves, what they say, how they engage people who disagree with them. That part of leadership is bound up inextricably.
But when you're in that particular position, I think when you're the president of the United States, the leader of the free world, character starts to become more important than just policy and how you carry yourself and what the office looks like and what you're also motivating amongst your population. And that's some of my biggest concern. Here's my question. As you stand back and look at what's happening with this administration, and they are moving at a breakneck pace. I mean, they are doing a lot of things. They've done so much in the past year that I think some of us have forgotten some things that they've done because there's been so many things happening. Here's my question. Do you feel like all this is truly calculated, or is it just more random and chaotic?
That's an excellent question. I think that for Trump himself, he is a rather mercurial, I wouldn't say random, but he is a chaotic person. I think he gets wild hairs and goes for it. He reads something, hears something, mostly hears something. Someone tells him something, it gets him jazzed, and he tweets and he goes. And then 3 days later, 10 days later, somebody else says something else, maybe about the same subject, maybe about a different subject, and he goes off in a different direction. During the first term, though, he was surrounded by people who were rather disciplined. And at least sometimes I thought maybe he or his closest advisors did that on purpose to create a bit of structure around someone that everybody that knew him and everybody's been following Donald Trump since the 1980s knows his personality. And that is largely missing in the second administration. In the second administration, almost everyone in the story, there are exceptions, but almost every one of them owes something very substantial to Trump. Like if he hadn't picked them for this job, they would otherwise be not obviously either gainfully employed or have significant roles in our political life and cultural life. That wasn't true for somebody like James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, or his first chiefs of staff, or other cabinet secretaries in the first term. In the second term, a lot of the, I'm not going to use pejorative terms, but they are certainly much more dependent on him and much less willing to engage in any kind of constraint or structure, put any kind of structure. So I think that the chaos that we have seen is natural to Trump, but it is also sort of a calculated decision by his administration to just let it happen rather than attempt to contain and channel it as was done during the first administration. I think that what I just said, Algernon, would probably be agreed to whether you thought his first administration was better than the second one or vice versa. I think the difference is pretty obvious. There just isn't any sense of sort of discipline and pacing. It just happens according to what the president wants to do today.
I think that's an excellent point that you just made. And I think when you zoom out and you look at the administration and the staff that he's appointed, You're spot on. I mean, this is just a merry band of Trump loyalists, and they all just want the boss to be happy. I mean, even the way he brings his whole cabinet out for every press conference, that's not normal. Like, we don't normally see a president constantly have all of his secretaries at every press conference, you know. But there, you know, John, there's so much that's been happening, and you pay closer attention than most people because that's just part of your role. That's the responsibility and the position that you have in our state. For my audience, for that business or that civic leader that doesn't have time to consume the amount of news and content that you do, maybe they're not reading as much as you are, maybe they're not, they don't have their finger on the pulse like you do. What's going on that might be missed right now? What is something that business and civic leaders need to really keep their eyes on?
Well, if we think about the main things the federal government influences, now it influences way too many things. And I would be a much bigger fan of this administration if it was genuinely getting the federal government out of lots more things and letting states and localities chart their own course. That would be fantastic. I wish that was more the modus operandi of this administration. But if you think about the main things the federal government is responsible for and what the Trump administration is doing, I think inadequate focus is placed on something I mentioned earlier. It's simply the size of government and the size of the deficits. They're gigantic. They have not been shrunk. All that DOGE talk early in the year, it was sort of, I think we even talked about this a year ago, focusing on federal employees, the staffing of federal agencies. We have such a fiscal emergency that I'm in favor of focusing on everything, on, you know, looking at everything. But the federal payroll is a tiny, it's like 4% or something of the total federal budget. So if you're used to thinking about, well, my company, if I had to cut my company's cost by 15%, I would have to do it through personnel. If I had to cut the state government, by the way, state government of North Carolina, the general fund, a much higher percentage of that money really does go to employees. Local government, city of Greensboro, county of Guilford, a huge percentage of your general fund, the budget you control directly, is personnel. It's not true for the federal government. So that DOGE stuff didn't really matter a whole lot. What actually mattered was an increase in the deficits because the president and his team have decided that Medicare and Social Security and some other big swaths of the federal budget are off limits. That's a lack of action. So I might have answered your question with, here are six things that they did that you didn't notice. What I'm saying is the most important thing for me is what they haven't done.
Yeah,
which is to really grapple with the fundamental economic challenge the federal government poses, which is the chronic deficits, the debt now north of 100% of GDP, the public held debt north of or about 100%, about to go up north of that. That in that direction lies disaster, calamity, collapse. That's the biggest thing. They're not doing anything about it. Now, the thing that they've done a lot in 2025 that hasn't got as much attention, I also alluded to earlier, and that's deregulation. So on the one hand, really nothing productive, very little productive, a little bit of Medicaid savings here and there, but nothing productive. All the savings they came up with, they just spent it in some other way.
Yeah.
But on the regulation side, a lot of the Trump administration's agencies, department heads, and so forth, they really have been pretty aggressively deregulating. That has a positive, in my view, a positive effect on the economy. So those are big things. I think I'm not going to mention tariffs, even though it's a big issue, because it has gotten a lot of attention, pro and con. But these other things, the lack of action on fiscal and the tremendous action on regulatory, deserve more attention.
And tariffs, that's going to be a big subject for this week, actually. Supreme Court will be ruling on whether or not these tariffs are legal. I know Bloomberg has been talking about it all week, and they seem to believe that Trump might get ruled against. So we'll see this week whether or not that occurs. You know, despite the fact that Trump has killed, you know, 130 people blowing up drug boats out in the Caribbean, the aggressive foreign policy move in Venezuela really took a lot of people off guard. This is not something that people were anticipating at all, despite the fact that Trump does a really good job of actually telegraphing.
He telegraphed it.
Everything that he's going to do, he actually tells you. But it sounds so aggressive and absurd that you think it's not real, but it actually turns out to be real. I guess from your perspective, does this represent a return to interventionism, or is it something different entirely? I mean, is this Iraq all over again?
It's not Iraq. It's not Afghanistan. It's just a different scenario. It is a little more like Noriega, Operation Just Cause in 89, or other previous interventions in Latin America by the U.S. in the past. The thing about Trump in foreign policy is that everyone wants to make him into some sort of elaborate, systematic thinker about foreign policy, and that has never been Donald Trump. It's never going to be him. This intervention in Venezuela has some justification. It was very poorly explained at the press conference and subsequent press conferences. If this really is, well, we're going to get their oil because it was stolen from oil companies years ago, and or we're going to call the shots because might makes right, which is what Stephen Miller said the other day on CNN. If that's true, that's, of course, not only is it not non-interventionist, it is more wild-eyed interventionist than Bush was. Because Bush's arguments had to do with public security. You know, the Iraq argument was, I mean, obviously we know now some of the aspects of the intelligence here were faulty, but the argument was it's an anti-American regime that sponsors terror. They have some chemical weapons and they're rebuilding their biological nuclear capacity. We can't wait until they get it. Those were the arguments.
Yeah.
Now, that the last part of that turned out that he was anti-American. He did support terrorists, but he didn't have the weapons we thought, the weapons programs. So that was a problem. In this case, it's much more naked. Just, well, we want some stuff. And the reason why this is problematic is the discussion of Greenland.
Yeah.
You cannot imagine a sensible administration doing what they did to Maduro. Again, there are arguments for it. They could have made the arguments, and Marco Rubio did make some of the arguments. But if you make that argument and you also say, and by the way, we want Greenland.
Yeah.
You have blown away all of your previous justifications for that seem to rest on the rule of law and true national security. And you're just turning it into, well, this is our sphere of influence and we're going to push people around.
Which, not to mention, they're also a member of NATO.
Exactly. I mean, it's absurd. There is absolutely no serious, in my view, and I know a few people that try to make a different argument. I don't see any serious policy argument for pushing Denmark to give us or sell us Greenland or else. If we need to put more military assets into Greenland, we could do it tomorrow.
Yeah,
the Danes aren't totally going to be against it. The Greenlanders aren't going to be against it. This is utter preposterous nonsense. It's not about security. This is an attempt to create some sort of a legacy. I added such and such amounts of square mileage to the U.S. territory or something, rather silly way to think about this.
And I think there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences, just as what we saw in Afghanistan and Iraq. But how much of this, from your professional viewpoint, how much of this is really originating out of the mind of Trump versus originating out of the mind of a Marco Rubio?
I think Rubio probably was a consistent advocate for doing something in Venezuela. And there were other people like the vice president, I am assuming, and the director of national intelligence who were consistent advocates against doing anything in Venezuela. And in this case, Rubio was successful. Again, I think you can make a case for doing something in Venezuela. It just have to be better explained, the end game, the involvement of the people who were legitimately elected, which there were two previous legitimately elected presidents who so far have been excluded from the transition. So I think this was an internal dispute. I think Trump a year ago probably never would have. He was not intending to do this. And whatever events or arguments prevailed on him. But I think ultimately he does like the idea of America taking rapid, not staying very long, shock and awe military action and getting stuff out of it. This is something that he talked about 20 years ago that he thought we should be doing.
Yeah, no, he's definitely returning us to the old days. I guess the golden age is as he calls it. But you know, shift and focus a little bit. You know, the president recently spoke to the House GOP caucus. And I recently posted about this because one of the things I liked about his speech is that this might have been the first time that I've heard President Trump acknowledge political reality, that he's not a king, that he can be impeached. And if Republicans don't win in the midterm elections, that there's a good chance that he will be impeached by Democrats. I think he was really, if you really listen to that hour and a half speech, That was probably about the most honest and transparent and raw that I've heard him speak about the election cycle that's coming up. And I'm curious and would love to get you to weigh in. Is there something that he's seeing internally that is speaking to disaster in the midterm election season? I know you're out talking to civic leaders, business leaders. You're talking to people all throughout the year. I mean, what's the mood of this electorate as we go into the midterms?
The Democrats, rightly or wrongly, the Democrats believe they're going to pretty easily take the U.S. House. And they think they have at least a shot of taking the U.S. Senate. Most of the Republicans that I know agree with them, that they think it's very likely the Democrats will take the House. And there's a shot, but it's not a high probability that the Democrats will take the Senate. That's the conventional wisdom. Now, the conventional wisdom can be wrong. And, you know, when you look at historical patterns, you have to be careful because things have changed over time. But almost all the lights are blinking red for the Republicans, not in a good way. You know? Yeah. And so that's what I think. And I think the president is probably right that a Democratic House will impeach him. I don't see the Senate convicting him. The impeachment, yeah, last three times now that we've seen the impeachment power played out, it just turned out to be impossible to get the votes in the Senate. I think impeachment as a genuine check or accountability mechanism is gone. And it's unfortunate, but I think it's a reality. And they'll, by the way, I think they will impeach the president on the use of his pardon power. They will say, there is no check on the pardon power in the Constitution. The only check is removal of the president. He's essentially selling pardons for political favors and money. And that's impeachable. And that's what they're going to do. And they're going to do it in 2027. And then it won't go anywhere in the Senate. So that would be my prediction. That's probably what he's talking about.
And I agree a lot of what you said. And it feels like in this particular election season or this cycle that we're going to go into, because here's the thing, I don't hear, you know, despite everything that we've saw in this administration the past year, I have heard not one single good policy idea from a Democrat. They still don't seem to have any ideas, any kind of policy agenda that they can sell to the American people. And my concern is, as we go into this next cycle, you know, John, are we moving into this phase where it's less about policy and ideas and those types of things? And it's just more about turnout and outrage and just getting people fired up and out to vote. But again, with no real agenda or ideas to coalesce around.
No, I think that is where we are. That's where the professionals on both sides think we already are. They just don't think policy matters very much. Ultimately, what do you want politics to do? It's to do policy. It is actually unfair to the Trump administration. They have done a lot of policy, whether you like it or not. They did a lot of policy. And the Democrats, in order to be an effective opposition party, need to have policy answers, not just negation. And there are some, to be fair, Algernon, I would say there is a caucus in the Democratic Congress and among Democratic governors that we might call the abundance liberals, the abundance Democrats. And they do, in fact, want to remove some impediments to growth and investment. They have much more of a government orientation than I do. But at least they do think that it's like takes too long to build roads, build houses, and build dams. And I mean, good, they're right. Let's figure that out. So there are some ideas out there. But on entitlements, I don't see the Democrats being any more serious than the Republicans. And their foreign policy it completely puzzles me. I don't understand. They want the U.S. to help Ukraine. They didn't want the U.S. to help Israel. At least a lot of them didn't. Now they're on Maduro's side, sort of, some of them. I mean, it's a very strange. You can't just be against anything the president says. You need to have a consistent position in order to, I think, build consensus to do something if and when you do get in power.
Yeah. And, you know, I watched this race last year with now Mayor Madami in New York. And, you know, obviously, you know my politics, you know my philosophy and ideology. So I don't agree with much of what I've heard out of the new mayor. But what I did find remarkable is at least he had ideas and he had policy ideas and he ran on those ideas and he convinced enough people that he had good ideas and they voted for him. And I just think that's the part of politics that disgusts me, that we're losing. Like we're not competing on ideas any longer. We're just trying to use fear and outrage to get the outcomes that we want. John, I'm running out of time, but Governor Jim Hunt passed away at the end of 2025. Regardless of party, he represented a kind of leadership that feels increasingly rare. I know you had a really, really close relationship with Governor Hunt, and would like for you to just maybe share with my audience a little bit about his impact and maybe even a couple things that we would be unaware of in terms of some of the work that Governor Hunt did.
Now, the first thing to know about him is he was a policy guy. We were just talking about a lack of policy. No one could argue that Governor Hunt lacked a substantive policy agenda. In fact, he had too much of it and worked all hours of the day and night to try to get it passed. And a lot of it he did. Some of it he didn't. After the Republican Revolutionary Year of 1994, when the Republicans took the North Carolina House for the first time, you know, since the 19th century, almost took the state Senate, we got a call at my office from Governor Hunt asking to speak to the John Locke Foundation, where and we said yes, of course, because that was interesting. And he came and spoke, and he pitched a tax cut that was bigger than the Republican proposal and outbid them on tax cuts. Now, he did that in part because I think he genuinely thought it was time to do some tax cuts, but also to build rapport so that then when he turned around and asked the Republicans for some help on some agenda items he was interested in, he had some relationship with them, the kind of politics that is required in order to accomplish anything. All right, I've got some power. You have some power. We're in different parties. If you help me with some of my agenda, I'll help you with some of your agenda. Let's talk is the way you get most things done, whether you're a conservative or a progressive or you live in New York, or you live in New Jersey, or you live in North Dakota. It doesn't matter. These are just basic ways that politics works, and that it doesn't work very well right now. The other thing I'll say about Jim Hunt, I enjoy every conversation I had with him. I usually had a goal in mind that I didn't accomplish because he immediately talked me off to something else. And I'm not at all the first person, I'm probably the 3,000th person to say there was a certain Jim Hunt grip. You know, he shook your hand, he took his other hand and put it on your elbow. And that was partly to pretend to be like friendlier than he was or whatever, just he never met a stranger kind of thing. But actually, you can't get away from him. He's got your hand and your arm, and he won't let go until you agree to listen to him. I mean, it wasn't aggressive or anything, it wasn't obnoxious. It was just very forceful, He was always a driven guy, and you want people to go into politics because they want to make their community better, which I think unambiguously he thought he was doing. And arguably he did on many areas, even as someone who didn't agree with him on some issues. He did make his state a better place, and he did strengthen the role of governors in North Carolina politics. He was very responsible for that.
Well, I can recall, obviously, I was not active when he was governor, but during his retirement years, once he'd become a lobbyist, he some kind of way I came on his radar. I think I was working with a state Senate candidate, and Governor Hunt had someone reach out to me. He asked if we would come to Raleigh and meet with him. I was very, very young at the time. I think maybe I had just finished the EA Mortgage program or something like that. And so I did get a chance to spend a couple hours just sitting at his feet and asking questions and him sharing ideas. So he was a remarkable person, remarkable man, and somebody that has had an impact on countless lives across North Carolina, and certainly represents an era that I feel like has slipped by in politics. You know, John, I'm wrapping up here. When you step back from the headlines, Washington, Venezuela, midterm elections, you know, what gives you the most concern, but also what gives you the most hope as we enter 2026?
I think the incoherence of the president's foreign policy gives me great concern. I mean, there are life and death, high stakes involved, economic questions too, all related to foreign policy. That concerns me. Greatest series of hope, though, is there are lots of states that are doing lots of interesting things. North Carolina is among them. Washington has become a place where problems go to fester. But in lots of state capitals, governors and legislatures of both parties, not in California, you know, there are places where it doesn't happen, but in lots of other places, Indiana, North Carolina, you know, lots of places, Mississippi, Tennessee, lots of interesting reforms are happening, making America a better place. And so I like to focus on the positive as much as possible. We're still a free country. Relatively speaking, we're still relatively freer than most of the rest of the world. We're still have relatively higher rates of economic investment and growth and productivity than the rest of the world. And no matter how hard they try, politicians can't seem to screw that up too much.
You know, John, I appreciate the depth and clarity you always bring to these conversations. We've covered a lot today. The exercise of power in Washington, the risk and repercussions of foreign intervention, the uncertainty heading into the midterms, and the reminder through Governor Hunt's life that leadership is ultimately about service, restraint, and responsibility. Whether people agree or disagree with any one position, these are conversations worth having, thoughtfully, historically, and without fear. John Hood, thank you for locking in with me. And to my audience, thank you for locking in with me. Make sure you stay tuned to WTOB, because every Sunday morning, that's where you can lock in with me. But if you happen to miss me there, you can catch it on the podcast, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, wherever you like to get your favorite podcasts. You can always lock in there. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.